You're listening to Crunch, a podcast by award-winning public relations agency, HMC. Crunch stands for Crucial Chats Over Lunch. These are bite-sized discussions for business leaders that can easily be digested over your lunch hour, on your morning commute, or whenever you listen to your favourite podcasts. Crunch tackles a variety of topics to help business leaders build their knowledge in strategic communication and public relations. On behalf of the HMC team, it's our privilege to welcome you into Crunch.
Well, let's move on to, I just wanted to talk a little bit about misinformation and disinformation. We've certainly, you know, in the last 10 years seen the rise of misinformation, disinformation, particularly on social media channels. And you talked earlier, Patrick, about how you, you know, if a story doesn't have numbers, you know, they're not citing something. That's one of the things that you need to tick off the box to make sure it is credible. But I guess, how has the rise of disinformation, misinformation, you know, has it changed the way newsrooms operate? Has it changed the way you fact check things?
I don't think it's yet started to change the way that we fact check things. I do wonder how artificial intelligence is going to affect that, because we're starting to use artificial intelligence not so much to write news, but to sift large chunks of information. I've had enough experience now with ChatGPT to know that it runs out of content. It's quite regular intervals. So, you know, it is basically cherry picking and stealing information from wherever it can find it in a very clever way. But sometimes it just isn't up to date.
So let's go there. Has anybody tried to pass a media release off to you and it's written by ChatGPT and you can tell?
Probably. I can't say that I've noticed it. Where you see it more is in job applications, but where you think, hang on, this is a bit sus. I don't think that things have changed that much at the moment. We still tend to want to go to primary sources or to quote individual people. I think what's more changed is that I don't think journalists have ever been a sort of massively popular group, but we've become less popular and much less trusted as a result of the rise of disinformation, misinformation, because people believe what they want to believe. And if we don't believe what they believe, or we don't report what they believe, then they think we're part of the plot. I don't worry about that too much, because I think there's an awful lot of volume around some of that activity, but not necessarily like a mainstream set of beliefs. So just got to kind of trust people not to be collectively completely stupid. The other thing is that there are so many different ways that people can have these theories. There's so many different conspiracy theories available that very often they don't actually represent a sort of a coherent group beyond being suspicious. They'll believe different odd things, whereas there still tend to be a bit of a consensus about broad facts. There's no doubt that Israel has responded extremely vigorously in Gaza, or that Russia invaded Ukraine. You can find any number of people on the internet who want to debate whether that was the United States' fault that either of those things happened, or whether it was, you know, some plot. That's less significant to me than whether the information that we can come by is verifiable in some way.
Kate, when we're working with our clients, like, what are some of the things that, with that misinformation, disinformation being a bigger issue than it was 10 years ago, you know, what are the things that, some of the things that we're helping our clients to, I guess, navigate that or be aware of that?
The first thing I noted down was really looking at how, as a business and your team, you can establish yourselves as a trustworthy source. So when you do say something in the media, people sit up and take notice and know it's like, well, it's coming from Nestle, but, you know, that must be credible because I know these guys are honest and have integrity. But obviously that takes time to do that. I think monitoring online conversations is something that businesses should be doing, and identifying that misinformation and then taking action early. When I say take action, you know, that doesn't mean engaging with people on social media or fueling the fire, or so having a strategy or seeking advice from a PR person about how you manage that type of misinformation. Because often, you know, we advise our clients to take it offline and deal with that person directly. Otherwise, you're just fueling the conversation and that misinformation. I think responding promptly and being transparent and publicly addressing concerns. And I suppose providing facts and talking to your PR expert about how you can counteract those false claims without it looking like you're being defensive or trying to hide something. Mm. And I think the big one for me is don't leave a void of information. You know, if there is misinformation or chatter going on out there, you need to tell your side of the story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to sound like I'm talking your book a bit, but I can't think of a good anecdotal example, but I've had so many experiences where the first time that a business has reached for communications advice has been when they've got into trouble. And you can kind of understand that. Most people don't have budgets for big comms plans and so forth. But if you're in a sector that is potentially exposed, a good example I could think of is genetic engineering of anything other than medicine. So even though the government is moving towards and is probably right in thinking that there's a lot less skepticism about that than there was 20 years ago, still shows up globally that people are much less willing to tangle with GE foods than just about any other new kind of technology. So if you haven't done the homework and put in the spade work early to be at least understood, if not trusted, but hopefully somewhat trusted, then if you're starting from the point where your trust, such trust as you may have had, has been destroyed before you even started, then you're starting from well behind the eight ball, because that's the one sort of big thing. Let's talk about this frankly for a moment. I mean, media thrives on crisis and discord. It's nothing we like better as an industry than to expose malfeasance or bad actors. And what I've seen over and over again is that trust takes forever to create and can be lost overnight. So even a small amount of investment in being trusted prior to getting into trouble is going to help.
Just thinking back to our very first Crunch episode, actually, when we were talking to one of our clients, Jeremy O'Rourke at Lodge Real Estate, and we talked about, like, yeah, building up that trust bank. So yeah, you need to have some stuff out there, because every single company is going to make a mistake someday. And if you're in business long enough, right? So you got to have that trust bank build up. You'll take a withdrawal from it, but, you know, hopefully people have seen you, they know you, and they trust you enough to say, oh man, they made a mistake, but I know them, you know, they'll make it right. So
if you wanted to think of a practical example, Air New Zealand, a loved brand in New Zealand, every brand monitor poll that comes out puts Air New Zealand in the top two or three. You think of the number of times that Air New Zealand is in the news for massively expensive regional aeroplane flights, anything that goes wrong, you know, parts of the media watch Air New Zealand like a hawk just to see whether the plane to New York has to turn back. Because they've got that deep well of goodwill, which has been built up over decades, they can get away with a heck of a lot more. I mean, the anecdotal flip side that I would give is a company like Fulton Hogan, which huge, you know, billions of dollars of turnover, thousands and thousands of employees in Australia and New Zealand, never had a media strategy because they've always taken this kind of South Islandy view that they shouldn't skite about things. They were absolutely gobsmacked and completely confused by the fact that they ended up with negative headlines throughout the COVID period because they didn't pay back the wage subsidy. They were so unused to any kind of media scrutiny that they kind of retreated into themselves. It's probably actually made them more inclined not to engage. But, you know, it's really interesting. A big, sophisticated company like that, just not used to having to have a public profile and only finding that it needed one when the shit hit the fan.
So, Patrick, you touched a little bit on AI. Do you feel like you want to go there again? Do you have anything else to say sort of on AI and how it's changing things with the media? I guess we saw last week that Stuff announced that they're partnering with Stryker and Microsoft to launch their AI tech pilot program to increase the number of Te Reo Māori articles, which I thought was a really interesting way to use AI. And you mentioned how you guys are using it a bit. And how is that going to change the way that news is reported? Will it impact it?
The interesting thing I think about the Stuff approach is that it's a bit similar to what we've done at Business Desk, which is that we use an AI engine to write very short news stories, mainly for taken from the New Zealand Stock Exchange for small companies that may not have a lot of investors and may not have a huge amount of interest. Certainly would take a reporter maybe an hour or more to write something, which we know very small readership for. The key to the way that we get that engine to write those stories, though, is that it only uses the information that's in that release. It doesn't search out into the internet and try to take a view or be clever. It just takes that information and says, I know what a news story is meant to look like. So now it looks like a news story. It doesn't always get it right. We have to watch the thing. But in theory, anyway, it is freeing up our other journalists to do more valuable work. I personally don't think that AI-generated writing is the future, but that's maybe because I'm just an analog person by nature. But I do think that, for example, very shortly the government will have all the submissions on the new RMA fast-track legislation will be dumped on the parliamentary website on that select committee's page. Normally, I would look at that and go, oh, my God, and try and work out whether two or three of them I should read. But if we were to put the what we're calling our angle finder over it, say, okay, tell me what are the things that come up all the time and where will I find those references in each of these submissions, it's possible, we're still in the early stages of this, possible it may actually help us to report much more deeply by making short work of what was previously probably an unachievable task, which is to read hundreds of submissions. I mean, we just haven't got time to do that.
When you talked about the AI writing stories, let's say from the New Zealand Stock Exchange, is a human looking at that, though, before you publish it?
I'm going to be honest and say the human doesn't necessarily look at that before they publish it. But
it's being very transparent, Patrick. Yeah.
The strike rate for error is probably lower than actually amongst humans.
Yeah, yeah.
But every now and again, we do have to pull something down and because it's kind of got the wrong end of the stick. But it's very unusual. But it's not high quality reporting. It's just taking whatever the company said and turning it into something a bit newsier.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
Surprisingly good, though.
It is. Yeah. Kate, how do you think AI is sort of changing the way that we create news stories?
You know, we've started using it a lot more at HMC. We're still exploring its value. Mm. I don't think it will ever replace the human touch. Mm. I always go through it with a fine tooth comb, make sure the tone of voice suits the client.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, a bit of quality control. I love it for grammar and punctuation. Mm. I do find it does repeat phrases, but I think as long as you are being transparent about using AI as well.
And it comes in so many shapes and forms, doesn't it? I mean, we use Grammarly, which is a form of AI, just massively improves the likelihood of getting commas, which that has, have, you know, all that stuff, it picks it up.
If you've got a good rule for the which versus that, Patrick, I'm still working that out.
I just asked Grammarly. I've never understood that distinction. I've got to be honest, I've never understood it. There's a comma involved, isn't there?
There is a comma involved, yes. I think too, for me, I found that, you know, what you get out of something like ChatGPT is only as good as what you put in.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, you need to give it instructions.
Good prompts, yeah.
Good prompts. And I think, you know, thinking about the ethical considerations for your business as well, in terms of maybe more around bias or data privacy, because it's drawing this information from a range of sources. So I think, yeah, really checking it before it goes anywhere.
Remains to be seen, but if the impact of AI is a little bit like the impact of social media, there should be an opportunity for journalism to be the more trusted source.
Yes.
I think the last point that I wanted to make, I think, you know, AI is actually going to help us create more engaging and meaningful content, which at the moment, in terms of standing out from the crowd, is just super important. So if AI can help us do that, then that's a positive.
It certainly has its place. But I think I agree with you, Patrick, and maybe because I am a bit old school as well, but I don't think it's going to replace humans anytime soon. We could be sitting here in 10 years' time and could have done that. But, you know, for us, I know we use it here and there, but at the end of the day, you need a human and you need a really good person who understands the client, who understands the industry, who understands how people are going to react to a story. And AI just isn't quite there yet.
Maybe it'll get so clever that it's actually capable of making judgments, but I'm not convinced that that's necessarily going to be replaced.
So let's say we have a new client come to us. Often we find that, you know, they come to us with a story, maybe perhaps it might be even a negative story, or maybe it's just a positive story and they haven't been in the news media before and they're a bit nervous about it. What do you have to say to companies who, business leaders that haven't done much media and might be a little bit nervous about engaging?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things I'd say, and just getting a bit commercial about it. Assuming that you've got something interesting to say that it's well-written and well-presented on Business Desk, for example, we have quality control on this. We don't want there to be crap on the site, but you can buy sponsored content in a reasonably prominent place where you can either offer advice or perspective, usually advisory, actually, tends to be. which is valuable to the readership, but which is your words. So you've chosen all the things you're going to say. The only barrier you've really got, well, two barriers. One, you've got to be willing to pay for it to be there. But the second is we will run an eye over it and say whether we think actually it's well-written or not. And, you know, you get a lot of materials, unsolicited material, which has got good material in it, but which, you know, they take 500 words to get to the point. The other thing is that, you know, podcasts such as the one we're doing now shouldn't underestimate the extent to which it's just like live radio, even though you can put your foot in it or express yourself in a way you didn't really mean to from time to time. The reality is that you get to say what you wanted to say in your own words and nobody can edit it. So I think increasingly we'll probably start doing interviews as if they were going to be a podcast, and we'll make the full audio or the full audio and video available linked from a story so that there is the opportunity to be heard saying what you said in the first place.
That's good. That's good to know. Yeah.
It's worthwhile because, yeah, you know, if you want to argue the toss about whether you've been misinterpreted or not, then you've got the source document basically. And I think we should be accountable for that. And I also think that we don't understand or know how every person wants to consume information. Some people want to hear the CEO explain it. Other people just want to cut to the chase and read about it.
I was just interested, you know, talking about something that's well-written and well-presented. You know, how important are those first few paragraphs of a media release? We talk to our clients about, you know, journalists are busy. They want to get the news angle or the scoop in the first or second paragraph. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure you don't do this, but it drives me nuts when people send a press statement saying, please see attached statement, and then it'll have a PDF that doesn't have a title. Why would I read that? What's in here? Give me some kind of clue.
Make it easy, yeah.
But also the other thing that you find a lot in, particularly amongst people who don't write for a living, is that they will throat clear for ages before they start getting to the point. So, you know, in these difficult times in the post-COVID era with Ukraine, blah, 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 and cost of living prices, what are we talking about here?
Get to it. Yeah.
Very often what I do is chop the first 300 words off, and it makes a lot more sense. I know that sounds a bit arrogant, but it's amazing how often it works. Once you've written something, see whether you can axe the first three sentences. You might be surprised at how quickly you come to the point. Because that's what people read as well. People want to read stuff that gets to the point. That's why in the old-fashioned news thing, you invert the pyramid with the most interesting fact first.
Yeah.
Nice. I think especially these days when we're all so time poor.
Yeah.
And you can get snippets of news on social media that are pretty short and sharp. You know, we don't have as much patience as we used to, I don't think.
Yeah.
It's like, just tell me. Yes. Tell me what you want me to hear.
Mm.
Well, if you ever receive a media release, well, you need to cut out the first three paragraphs from us, Patrick, then
we're retiring. So, Patrick, for business leaders listening today, as a leading New Zealand news editor, what would be your top few tips for businesses wanting to engage with media in this changing environment?
Get to know the reporter first. Don't be scared of numbers. Don't be scared of sounding interesting. And do the spade work before you get into trouble.
How about Kate? What are some of your tips?
Being transparent, and accessibility was a big one for me. You know, often clients want you to put out a media release, but then are unavailable to take a phone call, I can't talk until tomorrow. They need to make themselves available. And I think, I mean, we have a bit of a policy here, and I think, you know, journalists want access to the CEO or the GM. They don't want to go through the PR agency.
It's a brutal reality, and certainly one thing that's changed enormously in the last 30 years is access. The larger the organisation, the more likely it is that there will be some kind of formal process which you have to go through, which involves talking to somebody who's quite junior in the media team at a large corporate. And there are times, not every time that the CEO has to front, but there are times when the CEO really must front. Mm. And that's sometimes the most difficult time to get the CEO to realise they do.
You know, that's partly, you know, the job of PR professionals too, Patrick, is advising CEOs on that, you know, when they really need to step up and front it.
Mm. Yeah, it's a crisis management thing. It's, you know, so important for reputation that you're willing to take the responsibility for dealing with whatever the issue is that's arisen.
I think respecting deadlines was the other one.
Mm.
especially these days when
it's 24/7.
It's 24/7. You know,
what is a deadline now? That's the thing. I mean, you know, everything that lands can be written immediately, or we can take longer over it.
I think it's having that conversation with the journalist.
Mm.
But don't believe everything a journalist tells you about what the deadline might be. There's no reason to be bullied into
jumping really quickly,
more quickly than you're ready to. I suppose that's my other tip, as I've often said. You know, I'm arguing against my own interests here, but if a journalist catches you on the hop and wants to talk to you about something that's a bit difficult or that's not in your mind at the moment, or that you really feel like you need to do your homework on, just say, I'll ring you back in 10 minutes. But do make sure you ring back in 10 minutes. You're allowed to collect your thoughts.
For me, like if I could kind of summarize, is that media is still so important. And I think it's going back to what you were talking about earlier, Patrick, is that respected authoritative media in New Zealand and around the world is still trusted by those who we're trying to influence. So I think media still has a place. And I think if I think back to 20 years ago when I started at HMC, you know, I was working with media a lot more, but now there's so many channels available to us to get clients like news out to who they need to be in front of. It's become more difficult to get client, you know, especially like what we call a good news story into the media because there are fewer channels or looking for something different. So it's, I think it's easy for some organizations to maybe say, well, you know, if it's just too hard, then we'll just, you know, do it ourselves. But yeah, media is just so, still so important for that credibility, that third party endorsement. So, you know, companies need to figure out how to still engage with media, with key journalists as these changes continue to happen in the industry.
Well, I think it's a challenge for us as journalists as well, because we know that there's now all these amazingly diverse competing channels that mean that we can be completely ignored if you choose to and you do it well. So we need to make ourselves relevant in the process too. And that, I think, I hope anyway, maybe I'm just being an optimist, but I hope that means that, you know, journalists are prepared to do the work to understand the story rather than just look for the cheap angle. Will ultimately still prevail and still be able to find jobs in 25 years' time, because there will still be a demand for that.
So we always end our podcast the same way, Patrick. So CRUNCH stands for Crucial Chats Over Lunch. So we do our podcasts in a way that hopefully people can listen to them over the lunch hour. We always ask a lunch question to our guests. So as we head into colder weather, what is one of your favorite cold weather lunches when you want a bit of comfort food?
I would say a wonton noodle soup.
Right. How about you, Kate?
Well, I put soup too, Patrick. So, you know, I'm thinking you've been reading my notes. But mine is more, so, you know, I grew up on a farm and lived on a farm for a long time. So we always had bacon hocks in the freezer. And so I love nothing more than a good, like, chicken sort of based or vegetable soup with a bacon hock that's been stewing away in the crock pot for a few hours. So, and crusty bread on the side. I used to make my own bread. I don't have much time to do that anymore. But
oh, well, it'll be boring. Mine was soup as well. But I'm kind of famous for my soups, Patrick. I'm famous in Hamilton, at least. Famous with my husband. Yeah, so I love to make soup. And yeah, definitely, that's the cold weather lunch for me.
So that's 100% endorsement for soup.
Soup it is. I may need the contact or the recommendation from you for wonton soup down in Wellington.
Yeah, exactly.
Patrick,
I'm reporting this at home. I'm a figure of fun because of my enthusiasm for soup.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. And yeah, thanks a lot, Patrick, for joining us today on Crunch, and really just appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us today for the Crunch podcast, brought to you by New Zealand PR agency HMC. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss our next episode. See you next time.